heavy hand on the old man's shoulder and squeezed. "Leave her be!" The man turned, spoiling for a quarrel. But when he saw Gentry's size, he thought better of it.
"Your sister, is she? What kind of brother are you? I'd never bring no sister of mine to the beach. That I wouldn't."
He got up from the bench and moved off, muttering, in search of a new friend. "Why did you say that?" Arya hopped to her feet. "You're not my brother."
"That's right," he said angrily. "I'm too bloody low-born to be kin to my lady, I."
Arya was taken back by the fury in his voice. "That's not the way I meant it."
"Yes, it is."
He sat down on the bench, cradling a cup of wine between his hands. "Go away. I want to drink this wine in peace. Then maybe I'll go and find that black-haired girl and ring her bell for her."
"But I said, go away, my lady."
Arya whirled and left him there. A stupid, bull-headed, bastard boy, that's all he is. He could ring all the bells he wanted. It was nothing to her. Their sleeping room was at the top of the stairs under the eaves. Maybe the peach had no lack of beds, but there was only one to spare for the likes of them. It was a big bed, though. It filled the whole room, just about, and the musty straw-stuffed mattress looked large enough for all of them. Just now, though, she had it to herself. Her real clothes were hanging from a peg on the wall between Gendry's stuff and Lem's. Arya took off the linen and lace, pulled her tunic over her head, climbed up into the bed, and burrowed under the blankets. "Queen Cersei," she whispered into the pillow. "King Joffrey, Sir Ilion, Sir Meryn, Dunson, Raff and Polliver, the Tickler, the Hound, and Sir Gregor the Mountain." She liked to mix up the order of the name sometimes. It helped her remember who they were and what they'd done. "Maybe some of them are dead," she thought. "Maybe they're in iron cages somewhere, and the crows are picking out their eyes." Sleep came as quick as she closed her eyes. She dreamed of wolves that night, stalking through a wet wood with the smell of rain and rot and blood thick in the air. Only they were good smells in the dream, and Arya knew she had nothing to fear. She was strong and swift and fierce, and her pack was all around her, her brothers and sisters. They ran down a frightened horse together, tore its throat out, and feasted. And when the moon broke through the clouds, she threw back her head and howled. But when the day came, she woke to the barking of dogs. Arya sat up, yawning. Gendry was stirring on her left, and Lem Lemoncloak snoring loudly to her right. But the baying outside all but drowned them out. There must be 50 dogs out there. She crawled from under the blankets and hopped over Lem, Tom, and Jack-be-lucky to the window. When she opened the shutters wide, wind and wet and cold all came flooding in together. The day was grey and overcast. Down below in the square, the dogs were barking, running in circles, growling and howling. There was a pack of them, great black mastiffs and lean wolfhounds, and black-and-white sheepdogs, and kinds Arya did not know, shaggy, brindled beasts with long yellow teeth. Between the inn and the fountain, a dozen riders sat astride their horses, watching the townsman open the fat man's cage and tug his arm until his swollen corpse spilled out onto the ground. The dogs were at him at once, tearing chunks of flesh off his bones. Arya heard one of the riders laugh.
"Here's your new castle, you bloody Lannister bastard," he said. "A little snug for the likes of you, but we'll squeeze in, never fret."
Beside him, a prisoner sat sullen, with coils of hempen rope tight around his wrists. Some of the townsfolk were throwing dung at him, but he never flinched.
"You'll rot in them cages," his captor was shouting. "The crows will be picking out your eyes while we're spending all that good Lannister gold of yours. And when them crows are done, we'll send what's left of you to your bloody brother, though I doubt he'll know you."
The noise had woken half the peach. Gendry squeezed into the window beside Arya, and Tom stepped up behind them, naked as his name day.
"What's all the bloody shouting?" Lem complained from bed. "A man's trying to get some bloody sleep."
"Where's Greenbeard?" Tom asked him.
"Abed with Tansy," Lem said. "Why?"
"Best find him. Archer, too. The mad huntsman's come back with another man for the cages."
"Lannister," said Arya. "I heard him say Lannister."
"Have they caught the Kingslayer?" Gendry wanted to know.
Down in the square, a thrown stone caught the captive on the cheek, turning his head. Not the Kingslayer, Arya thought, when she saw his face. The gods had heard her prayers, after all.
Davos. Even in the gloom of the wolf's den, Davos Seaworth could sense that something was awry this morning. He woke to the sound of voices and crept to the door of his cell, but the wood was too thick, and he could not make out the words. Dawn had come, but not the porridge Garth brought him every morn to break his fast. That made him anxious. All the days were much the same inside the wolf's den, and any change was usually for the worse.
"This may be the day I die. Garth may be sitting with a whetstone even now to put an edge on Lady Lou."
The Onion Knight had not forgotten Wyman Manderley's last words to him. "Take this creature to the wolf's den and cut off head and hands," the fat lord had commanded. "I shall not be able to eat a bite until I see this smuggler's head upon a spike, with an onion shoved between his lying teeth." Every night Davos went to sleep with those words in his head, and every morn he woke to them. And should he forget, Garth was always pleased to remind him.
"Dead man," was his name for Davos. When he came by in the morning, it was always, "Here, porridge for the dead man." At night it was, "Blow out the candle, dead man."
Once Garth brought his ladies by to introduce them to the dead man.
"The ore don't look like much," he said, fondling a rod of coal-black iron. "But when I heat her up red-hot and let her touch your cock, oh, you cry for mother. And this here's my Lady Lou. It's her who'll take your head and hands when Lord Wyman sends down word."
Davos had never seen a bigger axe than Lady Lou, nor one with a sharper edge. Garth spent his days honing her, the other keepers said. "I will not plead for mercy," Davos resolved. He would go to his death a knight, asking only that they take his head before his hands. Even Garth would not be so cruel as to deny him that, he hoped. The sounds coming through the door were faint and muffled. Davos rose and paced his cell. As cells went, it was large and queerly comfortable. He suspected it might once have been some lordling's bedchamber. It was thrice the size of his captain's cabin on Black Besser, and even larger than the cabin Salador San enjoyed on his Valerian. Though its only window had been bricked in years before, one wall still boasted a hearth big enough to hold a kettle, and there was an actual privy built into a corner nook. The floor was made of warped planks full of splinters, and his sleeping pallet smelled of mildew, but those discomforts were mild compared to what Davos had expected. The food had come as a surprise as well. In place of gruel and stale bread and rotten meat, the usual dungeon fare, his keepers brought him fresh-caught fish, bread still warm from the oven, spiced mutton, turnips, carrots, even crabs. Garth was none too pleased by that.
"The dead should not eat better than the living," he complained more than once.
Davos had furs to keep him warm by night, wood to feed his fire, clean clothing, a greasy tallow candle. When he asked for paper, quill, and ink, Theory brought them the next day. When he asked for a book so he might keep at his reading, Theory turned up with a seven-pointed star. For all its comforts, though, his cell remained a cell. Its walls were solid stone, so thick he could hear nothing of the outside world. The door was oak and iron, and his keepers kept it barred. Four sets of heavy iron fetters dangled from the ceiling, waiting for the day Lord Manderley decided to chain him up and give him over to the whore. "Today may be that day. The next time Garth opens my door, it may not be to bring me porridge." His belly was rumbling, a sure sign that the morning was creeping past, and still no sign of food. "The worst part is not the dying. It's not knowing when or how." He had seen the inside of a few jails and dungeons in his smuggling days, but those he'd shared with other prisoners, so there was always someone to talk with, to share your fears and hopes. Not here. Aside from his keepers, Davis Seaworth had the wolf's den to himself. He knew there were true dungeons done in the castle cellars, oubliettes and torture chambers, and dank pits where huge black rats scrabbled in the darkness. His jailers claimed all of them were unoccupied at present. "Only us here, Onion," Sir Bartimus had told him. He was a chief jailer, a cadaverous one-legged knight, with a scarred face and a blind eye. When Sir Bartimus was in his cups, and Sir Bartimus was in his cups most every day, he liked to boast of how he had saved Lord Wyman's life at the Battle of the Trident. The wolf's den was his reward. The rest of us consisted of a cook Davis never saw, six guardsmen in the ground floor barracks, a pair of washerwomen, and the two turnkeys who looked after the prisoner. Therry was the young one, the son of one of the washerwomen, a boy of 10 and 4. The old one was Garth, huge and bald and taciturn, who wore the same greasy leather jerkin every day and always seemed to have a glower on his face. His years as a smuggler had given Davis Seaworth a sense of when a man was wrong, and Garth was wrong. The Onion Knight took care to hold his tongue in Garth's presence. With Theory and Sir Bartimus, he was less reticent. He thanked them for his food, encouraged them to talk about their hopes and histories, answered their questions politely, and never pressed too hard with queries of his own. When he made requests, they were small ones. A basin of water and a bit of soap, a book to read, more candles. Most such favours were granted, and Davis was duly grateful. Neither man would speak about Lord Manderley, or King Stannis, or the Freys, but they would talk of other things. Theory wanted to go off to war when he was old enough, to fight in battles and become a knight. He liked to complain about his mother, too. She was bedding two of the guardsmen, he confided. The men were on different watches, and neither knew about the other. But one day one man or t'other would puzzle it out. Then there would be blood. Some nights the boy would even bring a skin of wine to the cell and ask Davis about the smuggler's life as they drank. Sir Bartimus had no interest in the world outside, or indeed anything that had happened since he lost his leg to a riderless horse and a maester's saw. He had come to love the wolf's den, however, and liked nothing more than to talk about its long and bloody history. The den was much older than White Harbour, the knight told Davis. It had been raised by King John Stark to defend the mouth of the White Knife against raiders from the sea. Many a younger son of the king in the north had made his seat there. Many a brother, many an uncle, many a cousin. Some pass the castle to their own sons and grandsons, and offshoot branches of House Stark had arisen. The Grey Starks had lasted the longest, holding the wolf's den for 5 centuries, until they presumed to join the dread fort in rebellion against the Starks of Winterfell. After their fall, the castle had passed through many other hands. House Flint had held it for a century, House Locke for almost 2. Slates, Longs, Holts, and Ashwoods had held sway here, charged by Winterfell to keep the river safe. Reavers from the Three Sisters took the castle once, making it their toehold in the north. During the wars between Winterfell and the Vale, it was besieged by Osgood Aaron, the old Falcon, and burned by his son, the one remembered as the Talon. When old King Edric Stark had grown too feeble to defend his realm, the Wolf's Den was captured by slavers from the Stepstones. They would brand their captives with hot irons and break them to the whip before shipping them off across the sea, and these same Blackstone walls bore witness. "Then a long, cruel winter fell," said Sir Bartimus. "The White Knife froze hard, and even the Firth was icing up. The winds came howling from the north and drove them slavers inside to huddle round their fires, and whilst they warmed themselves the new king came down on them. Brandon Stark, this was. Edric Snowbeard's great-grandson. Him that men called Ice Eyes. He took the Wolf's Den back, stripped the slavers naked, and gave them to the slaves he'd found chained up in the dungeons. It is said they hung their entrails in the branches of the heart tree as an offering to the gods. The old gods, not these new ones from the south. Your seven don't know winter, and winter don't know them." Davis could not argue with the truth of that. From what he had seen at Eastwatch by the sea, he did not care to know winter either. "What gods do you keep?" he asked the one-legged knight. "The old ones." When Sir Bartimus grinned, he looked just like a skull. "Me and mine were here before the Mandalays. Like as not, my own forebears strung those entrails through the tree. I never knew that Northmen made blood sacrifice to their art trees." "There's much and more you Southrons do not know about the North," Sir Bartimus replied. He was not wrong. Davis sat beside his candle and looked at the letters he had scratched out word by word during the days of his confinement. "I was a better smuggler than a knight," he had written to his wife, "a better knight than a king's hand, a better king's hand than a husband. I am so sorry. Marrier, I have loved you. Please forgive the wrongs I did you. Should Stannis lose his war, our lands will be lost as well. Take the boys across the narrow sea to Braavos, and teach them to think kindly of me, if you would. Should Stannis gain the Iron Throne, House Seaworth will survive, and Devon will remain at court. He will help you place the other boys with noble lords, where they can serve as pages and squires, and win their knighthoods." It was the best counsel he had for her, though he wished it sounded wiser. He had written to each of his three surviving sons as well, to help them to remember the father who had bought them names with his fingertips. His notes to Stefan and young Stannis were short and stiff and awkward. If truth be told, he did not know them half as well as he had his older boys, the ones who burned or drowned upon the Blackwater. To Devon he wrote more, telling him how proud he was to see his own son as a king's squire, and reminding him that as the eldest it was his duty to protect his lady mother and his younger brothers. "Tell his grace I did my best," he ended. "I'm sorry that I failed him. I lost my luck when I lost my finger bones the day the river burned below King's Landing." Davos shuffled through the letters slowly, reading each one over several times, wondering whether he should change a word here or add one there. A man should have more to say when staring at the end of his life, he thought, but the words came hard. "I did not do so ill," he tried to tell himself. "I rose up from Flea Bottom to be a king's hand, and I learned to read and write." He was still hunched over the letters when he heard the sound of iron keys rattling on a ring. Half a heartbeat later, the door to his cell came swinging open. The man who stepped through the door was not one of his jailers. He was tall and haggard, with a deeply lined face and a shock of grey-brown hair. A longsword hung from his hip, and his deep-dyed scarlet cloak was fastened at the shoulder with a heavy silver brooch in the shape of a mailed fist. "Lord Seaworth," he said, We do not have much time. Please, come with me. Davis eyed the stranger warily. The please confused him. Men about to lose their heads and hands were not oft accorded such courtesies.
Who are you?
Robert Glover, if it please, my lord.
Glover? Oh, your seat was Deepwood Mutt.
My brother Gulbert's seat. It was and is, thanks to your King Stannis. He has taken Deepwood back from the iron bitch who stole it, and offers to restore it to its rightful owners. Much and more has happened whilst you have been confined within these walls, Lord Davis. Moat Cailin has fallen, and Roose Bolton has returned to the north with Ned Stark's younger daughter. A host of Freys came with him. Bolton has sent forth ravens, summoning all the lords of the north to Barrowton. He demands homage and hostages, and witnesses to the wedding of Arya Stark and his bastard Ramsay Snow, by which match the Boltons mean to lay claim to Winterfell. Now, will you come with me or no?
What choice do I have, my lord? Come with you, or remain with Garth and Lady Lou?
Who is Lady Lou? One of the washerwomen? Glover was growing impatient. All will be explained if you will come. Davis rose to his feet.
If I should die, I beseech my lord to see that my letters are delivered.
You have my word on that, though if you die, it will not be at Glover hands, nor Lord Wyman's. Quickly now, with me.
Glover led him along a darkened hall and down a flight of worn steps. They crossed the castle's godswood, where the heart tree had grown so huge and tangled that it had choked out all the oaks and elms and birch, and sent its thick, pale limbs crashing through the walls and windows that looked down on it. Its roots were as thick around as a man's waist, its trunk so wide that the face carved into it looked fat and angry. Beyond the weirwood, Glover opened a rusted iron gate and paused to light a torch. When it was blazing red and hot, he took Davis down more steps into a barrel-vaulted cellar, where the weeping walls were crusted white with salt, and sea-water sloshed beneath their feet with every step. They passed through several cellars and rows of small, damp, foul-smelling cells, very different from the room where Davis had been confined. Then there was a blank stone wall that turned when Glover pushed on it. Beyond was a long, narrow tunnel, and still more steps. These led up.
"Where are we?"
asked Davis as they climbed. His words echoed faintly through the darkness.
"The steps beneath the steps. The passage runs beneath the castle stair, up to the new castle, a secret way. It would not do for you to be seen, my lord. You are supposed to be dead."
"Porridge for the dead man." Davis climbed. They emerged to another wall, but this one was lath and plaster on the far side. The room beyond was snug and warm and comfortably furnished, with a mirrorish carpet on the floor and beeswax candles burning on a table. Davis could hear pipes and fiddles playing, not far away. On the wall hung a sheepskin with a map of the north painted across it in faded colours. Beneath the map sat Wyman Manderley, the colossal lord of White Harbour.
"Please sit."
Lord Manderley was richly garbed. His velvet doublet was a soft blue-green, embroidered with golden thread at hem and sleeves and collar. His mantle was ermine, pinned at the shoulder with a golden trident.
"Are you hungry?"
"No, my lord. Your jailers have fed me well."
"There is wine, if you have a thirst."
"I will treat with you, my lord. My king commanded that of me. I do not have to drink with you." Lord Wyman sighed.
"I have treated you most shamefully, I know. I had my reasons, but please, sit and drink, I beg you. Drink to my boy's safe return. Willis, my eldest son and heir, is home. That is the welcoming feast you hear. In the merman's court they are eating lamprey pie and venison with roasted chestnuts. Winifred is dancing with the Frey she is to marry. The other Freys are raising cups of wine to toast our friendship.
Beneath the music, Davis could hear the murmur of many voices, the clatter of cups and platters. He said nothing.
"I have just come from the high table," Lord Wyman went on. "I have eaten too much as ever, and all White Harbour knows my bowels are bad. My friends of Frey will not question a lengthy visit to the privy, we hope." He turned his cup over. "There, you will drink, and I will not. Sit, time is short, and there is much we need to say. Robert, wine for the hand, if you'll be so good. Lord Davis, you will not know, but you are dead."
Robert Glover filled a wine cup and offered it to Davis. He took it, sniffed it, drank.
"How did I die, if I may ask?"
"By the axe. Your head and hands were mounted above the seal gate, with your face turned so your eyes looked out across the harbour. By now you are well rotted. Though we dipped your head in tar before we set it upon the spike. Carrion crows and seabirds squabbled over your eyes, they say."
Davis shifted uncomfortably. It was a queer feeling, being dead. "If it pleased my lord, who died in my place?"
"Does it matter?
You have a common face, Lord Davis. I hope my saying so does not offend you. The man had your collaring, a nose of the same shape, two ears that were not dissimilar, a long beard that could be trimmed and shaped like yours. You can be sure we tarred him well, and the onion shoved between his teeth served to twist the features. Sir Bartimus saw that the fingers of his left hand were shortened, the same as yours. The man was a criminal, if that gives you any solace. His dying may accomplish more good than anything he ever did whilst living. My lord, I bear you no ill will. The rancour I showed you in the Merman's Court was a mummer's farce put on to please our friends of Frey."
"My lord should take up a life of mummery," said Davis. "You and yours were most convincing. Your good daughter seemed to want me dead most earnestly, and the little girl..."
"Willa," Lord Wyman smiled. "Did you see how brave she was? Even when I threatened to have her tongue out, she reminded me of the debt White Harbour owes to the Starks of Winterfell, a debt that can never be repaid. Willa spoke from the heart, as did Lady Leona. Forgive her if you can, my lord. She is a foolish, frightened woman, and Willis is her life. Not every man has it in him to be Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight or Simeon Star-Eyes. And not every woman can be as brave as my Willa and her sister Winifred, who did know, yet played her own part fearlessly. When treating with liars, even an honest man must lie. I did not dare defy King's Landing, so long as my last living son remained a captive. Lord Tywin Lannister wrote me, himself, to say that he had Willis. If I would have him freed unharmed, he told me, I must repent my treason, yield my city, declare my loyalty to the boy king on the Iron Throne, and bend my knee to Roose Bolton, his warden of the north. Should I refuse, Willis would die a traitor's death. White Harbour would be stormed and sacked, and my people would suffer the same fate as the reigns of Castamere. I am fat, and many think that makes me weak and foolish. Mayhaps Tywin Lannister was one such. I sent him back a raven to say that I would bend my knee and open my gates after my son was returned, but not before. There the matter stood when Tywin died. Afterwards the Freys turned up with Wendell's bones to make a peace and seal it with a marriage pact, they claimed. But I was not about to give them what they wanted until I had Willis safe and whole. And they were not about to give me Willis until I proved my loyalty. Your arrival gave me the means to do that. That was the reason for the discourtesy I showed you in the Merman's Court, and for the head and hands rotting above the sealed gate. "You took a great risk, my lord," Davis said. "If the Freys had seen through your deception..."
"I took no risk at all. If any of the Freys had taken it upon themselves to climb my gate for a close look at the man with the onion in his mouth, I would have blamed my jailers for the error, and produced you to appease them."
Davis felt a shiver up his spine.
"I see. I hope so. You have sons of your own, you said."
"Three," thought Davis, "though I fathered seven. Soon I must return to the feast to toast my friends of Frey." Mandalay continued. "They watch me, sir. Day and night their eyes are on me, noses sniffing for some whiff of treachery. You saw them. The arrogant Sir Jared and his brother Rhaegar. That smirking worm who wears a dragon's name. Behind them both stands Simon, clinking coins. That one has bought and paid for several of my servants and two of my knights. One of his wife's handmaids has found her way into the bed of my own fool. If Stannis wonders that my letters say so little, it is because I dare not even trust my maester. Theomore is all head and no heart. You heard him in my hall. Maesters are supposed to put aside all loyalties when they don their chains. But I cannot forget that Theomore was born a Lannister of Lannisport, and claims more distant kinship to the Lannisters of Casterly Rock. Foes and false friends are all around me, Lord Davis. They infest my city like roaches, and at night I feel them crawling over me." The fat man's fingers coiled into a fist, and all his chins trembled. "My son Wendell came to the twins a guest. He ate Lord Walder's bread and salt, and hung his sword upon the wall to feast with friends. And they murdered him. Murdered, I say. And may the Freys choke upon their fables. I drink with Jared, jape with Simon, promise Rhaegar the hand of my own beloved granddaughter, but never think that means I have forgotten. The North remembers, Lord Davis. The North remembers, and the mummer's farce is almost done. My son is home." Something about the way Lord Wyman said that chilled Davis to the bone. "If it is justice that you want, my lord, look to King Stannis. No man is more just." Robert Glover broke in to add, "Your loyalty does you honour, my lord, but Stannis Baratheon remains your king, not our own." "Your own king is dead," Davis reminded them. "Murdered at the Red Wedding beside Lord Wyman's son." "The young wolf is dead," Mandalay allowed. "But that brave boy was not Lord Eddard's only son. Robert, bring the lad." "At once, my lord." Glover slipped out of the door. The lad? Was it possible that one of Robb Stark's brothers had survived the ruin of Winterfell? Did Mandalay have a Stark heir hidden away in his castle? A found boy or a feigned boy? The North would rise for either, he suspected. But Stannis Baratheon would never make common cause with an impostor. The lad who followed Robert Glover through the door was not a Stark, nor could he ever hope to pass for one. He was older than the young wolf's murdered brothers, 14 or 15 by the look of him, and his eyes were older still. Beneath a tangle of dark brown hair, his face was almost feral, with a wide mouth, sharp nose, and pointed chin. "Who are you?" Davis asked. The boy looked to Robert Glover. "He's a mute, but we have been teaching him his letters. He learns quickly." Glover drew a dagger from his belt and gave it to the boy. "Write your name for Lord Seaworth." There was no parchment in the chamber. The boy carved the letters into a wooden beam in the wall. W-E-X. He leaned hard into the X. When he was done, he flipped the dagger in the air, caught it, and stood admiring his handiwork.
Wex is Ironborn. He was Theon Greyjoy's squire. Wex was at Winterfell, Glover said. How much does Lord Stannis know of what transpired at Winterfell? Davos thought back on the tales he'd heard. Winterfell was captured by Theon Greyjoy, who had once been Lord Stark's ward. He had Stark's two young sons put to death and mounted their heads above the castle walls. When the Northmen came to oust him, he put the entire castle to sword, down to the last child, before he himself was slain by Lord Bolton's bastard. Not slain, said Glover, captured, and carried back to the Dreadfort. The bastard has been flaying him. Lord Wyman nodded. The tale you tell is one we all have heard, as full of lies as a pudding's full of raisins. It was the bastard of Bolton who put Winterfell to the sword. Ramsay Snow, he was called then, before the boy king made him a Bolton. Snow did not kill them all. He spared the women, roped them together, and marched them to the Dreadfort for his sport. His sport? He's a great hunter, said Wyman Manderley, and women are his favourite prey. He strips them naked and sets them loose in the woods. They have a half-day's start before he sets out after them with hounds and horns. From time to time some wench escapes and lives to tell the tale. Most are less fortunate. When Ramsay catches them, he rapes them, flays them, feeds their corpses to his dogs, and brings their skins back to the Dreadfort as trophies. If they have given him good sport, he slits their throats before he skins them. Elsewise, t'other way around. Davos paled. Gods be good. How could any man? The evil is in his blood, said Robert Glover. He is a bastard born of rape. A Snow, no matter what the boy king says. Was ever Snow so black? Asked Lord Wyman. Ramsay took Lord Hornwood's lands by forcibly wedding his widow, then locked her in a tower and forgot her. It is said she ate her own fingers in her extremity. And the Lannister notion of king's justice is to reward her killer with Ned Stark's little girl. The Boltons have always been as cruel as they were cunning, but this one seems a beast in human skin, said Glover. The Lord of White Harbour leaned forward. The Freys are no better. They speak of wargs and skin changers and assert that it was Rob Stark who slew my Wendell. The arrogance of it! They do not expect the North to believe their lies, not truly. But they think we must pretend to believe, or die. Roose Bolton lies about his part in the Red Wedding, and his bastard lies about the fall of Winterfell. And yet so long as they held Willis, I had no choice but eat all this excrement and praise the taste. And now, my lord, asked Davos. He had hoped to hear Lord Wyman say, and now I shall declare for King Stannis. But instead, the fat man smiled an odd, twinkling smile and said, and now I have a wedding to attend. I'm too fat to sit a horse, as any man with eyes can plainly see. As a boy, I love to ride, and as a young man, I handle a mount well enough to win some small acclaim in the lists. But those days are done. My body has become a prison more dire than the wolf's den. Even so, I must go to Winterfell. Roose Bolton wants me on my knees, and beneath the velvet courtesy, he shows the iron mail. I shall go by barge and litter, attended by 100 knights and my good friends from the Twins. The Freys came here by sea. They have no horses with them, so I shall present each of them with a palfrey as a guest gift. Do hosts still give guest gifts in the south?
Some do, my lord, on the day their guest departs.
Perhaps you understand, then.
Wyman Manderley lurched ponderously to his feet. "I have been building warships for more than a year. Some you saw. But there are as many more hidden up the White Knife. Even with the losses I have suffered, I still command more heavy horse than any other lord north of the Neck. My walls are strong, and my vaults are full of silver. Oldcastle and Widow's Watch will take their lead from me. My bannermen include a dozen petty lords and 100 landed knights. I can deliver King Stannis the allegiance of all the lands east of the White Knife, from Widow's Watch and Ramsgate to the Sheep's Head Hills and the headwaters of the Broken Branch. All this I pledge to do. If you will meet my price, I can bring your terms to the king, but—" Lord Wyman cut him off. "If you will meet my price," I said, "not Stannis. It's not a king I need, but a smuggler." Robert Glover took up the tale. "We may never know all that happened at Winterfell, when Sir Roderick Cassel tried to take the castle back from Theon Greyjoy's iron men. The bastard of Bolton claims that Greyjoy murdered Sir Roderick during a parley. Weck says no. Until he learns more letters, we will never know half the truth. But he came to us knowing yes and no, and those can go a long way once you find the right questions. It was the bastard who murdered Sir Roderick and the men of Winterfell," said Lord Wyman. "He slew Greyjoy's iron men as well. Weck saw men cut down, trying to yield. When we asked how he escaped, he took a chunk of chalk and drew a tree with a face. Davos thought about that. The old guard saved him, after a fashion. He climbed the heart tree and hid himself amongst the leaves. Bolton's men searched the God's Wood twice and killed the men they found there, but none thought to clamber up into the trees. Is that how it happened, Wex?" The boy flipped up Glover's dagger, caught it, nodded. Glover said, "He stayed up in the tree a long time. He slept amongst the branches, not daring to descend. Finally, he heard voices down beneath him." "The voices of the dead," said Wyman Manderley. Wex held up five fingers, tapped each one with a dagger, then folded four away and tapped the last again. "Six of them?" asked Davos. "There were six. Two of them Ned Stark's murder sons. How could a mute tell you that? With chalk, he drew two boys and two wolves. The lad is ironborn, so he thought it best not to show himself," said Glover. "He listened. The six did not linger long amongst the ruins of Winterfell. Four went one way, two another. Weck stole after the two, a woman and a boy. He must have stayed downwind so the wolf would not catch his scent. He knows where they went," Lord Wyman said. Davos understood. "You want a boy. Roose Bolton has Lord Eddard's daughter to thwart him. White Harbour must have Ned's son and the direwolf. The wolf will prove the boy is who we say he is, should the Dreadfort attempt to deny him. That is my price, Lord Davos. Smuggle me back, my liege lord, and I will take Stannis Baratheon as my king." Old instinct made Davos Seaworth reach for his throat. His finger bones had been his luck, and somehow he felt he would have need of luck to do what Wyman Manderley was asking of him. The bones were gone, though, so he said, "You have better men than me in your service, knights and lords and maesters. Why would you need a smuggler? You have ships?" "Ships," Lord Wyman agreed, "but my crews are rivermen or fisherfolk who have never sailed beyond the Bight. For this I must have a man who sailed in darker waters and knows how to slip past dangers unseen and unmolested." "Where is the boy?" Somehow Davos knew he would not like the answer. "Where is it you want me to go, my lord?" Robert Glover said, "Wex, show him."
The mute flipped the dagger, caught it, then flung it end over end at the sheepskin map that adorned Lord Wyman's wall. It struck, quivering. Then he grinned. For half a heartbeat, Davis considered asking Wyman Manderley to send him back to the wolf's den, to serve Bartimus with his tails and Garth with his lethal ladies. In the den, even prisoners ate porridge in the morning. But there were other places in this world where men were known to break their fast on human flesh.
Sansa wrote to the Hands Tourney with Septa Mordane and Jane Poole in a litter with curtains of yellow silk so fine she could see right through them. They turned the whole world gold. Beyond the city walls, 100 pavilions had been raised beside the river, and the common folk came out in the thousands to watch the games. The splendour of it all took Sansa's breath away. The shining armour, the great chargers, caparisoned in silver and gold, the shouts of the crowd, the banners snapping in the wind, and the knights themselves, the knights, most of all. "It is better than the songs," she whispered, when they found the places that her father had promised her, among the high lords and ladies. Sansa was dressed beautifully that day in a green gown that brought out the auburn of her hair, and she knew they were looking at her and smiling. They watched the heroes of 100 songs ride forth, each more fabulous than the last. The 7 knights of the King's Guard took the field, all but Jaime Lannister, in scaled armour the colour of milk, their cloaks as white as fresh-fallen snow. Sir Jaime wore the white cloak as well, but beneath it he was shining gold from head to foot, with a lion's head helm and a golden sword. Sir Gregor Clegane, the mountain that rides, thundered past them like an avalanche. Sansa remembered Lord Jon Royce, who had guested at Winterfell 2 years before. "His armour is bronze, thousands and thousands of years old, engraved with magic runes that ward him against harm," she whispered to Jane. Septa Mordane pointed out Lord Jason Mallister, in indigo chased with silver, the wings of an eagle on his helm. He had cut down 3 of Rhaegar's bannermen on the Trident. The girls giggled over the warrior priest, Thoris of Myr, with his flapping red robes and shaven head, until the scepter told them that he had once scaled the walls of Pike with a flaming sword in hand. Other riders, Sansa did not know, hedge knights from the Fingers and Highgarden and the Mountains of Dawn, unsung free riders and new-made squires, the younger sons of high lords and the heirs of lesser houses. Younger men, most had done no great deeds as yet, but Sansa and Jane agreed that one day the 7 kingdoms would resound to the sound of their names. Sir Balon Swan, Lord Bryce Caron of the Marches, Bronze Yon's heir, Sir Andar Royce, and his younger brother, Sir Robar, and their silver steel plate filigreed in bronze with the same ancient runes that warded their father. The twins, Sir Horace and Sir Hubba, whose shields displayed the grape cluster sigil of the Red Wines, burgundy on blue. Patrick Mallister, Lord Jason's son. 6 Freys of the Crossing. Sir Jared, Sir Hosteen, Sir Danwell, Sir Emmon, Sir Theo, Sir Perwin, sons and grandsons of old Lord Walder Frey, and his bastard son Martin Rivers as well. Jane Poole confessed herself frightened by the look of Jarabar Zo, an exiled prince from the Summer Isles, who wore a cape of green and scarlet feathers over skin as dark as night. But when she saw young Lord Beric Dondarrion, with his hair like red gold and his black shield slashed by lightning, she pronounced herself willing to marry him on the instant. The Hound entered the list as well, and so too the king's brother, handsome Lord Renly of Storm's End. Jory, Alan and Harwin rode for Winterfell on the north. "Jarre looks a beggar amongst these others," Septa Mordane sniffed when he appeared. Sansa could only agree. Jory's armour was blue-grey plate without device or ornament, and a thin grey cloak hung from his shoulders like a soiled rag. Yet he acquitted himself well, unhorsing Horace Redwine in his first joust, and one of the Freys in his second. In his third match he rode three passes at a free rider named Lothar Brun, whose armour was as drab as his own. Neither man lost his seat, but Brun's lance was steadier and his blows better placed, and the king gave him the victory. Alan and Harwin fared less well. Harwin was unhorsed in his first tilt by Sir Merrin of the King's Guard, while Alan fell to Sir Balan Swan. The jousting went on all day and into the dusk, the hooves of the great war horses pounding down the lists until the field was a ragged wasteland of torn earth. A dozen times Jane and Sansa cried out in unison as riders crashed together, lances exploding into splinters, while the common screamed for their favourites. Jane covered her eyes whenever a man fell, like a frightened little girl, but Sansa was made of sterner stuff. A great lady knew how to behave at tournaments. Even Septa Mordane noted her composure and nodded in approval. The Kingslayer rode brilliantly. He overthrew Sir Andar Royce and the marcher Lord Bryce Caron as easily as if he were riding at rings, and then took a hard-fought match from white-haired Barristan Selmy, who had won his first two tilts against men 30 and 40 years his junior. Sandor Clegane and his immense brother, Sir Gregor the Mountain, seemed unstoppable as well, riding down one foe after the next in ferocious style. The most terrifying moment of the day came during Sir Gregor's second joust, when his lance rode up and struck a young knight from the Vale under the gorget with such force that it drove through his throat, killing him instantly. The youth fell not 10 feet from where Sansa was seated. The point of Sir Gregor's lance had snapped off in his neck, and his life's blood flowed out in slow pulses, each weaker than the one before. His armour was shiny new. A bright streak of fire ran down his outstretched arm as the steel caught the light. Then the sun went behind a cloud, and it was gone. His cloak was blue, the colour of the sky on a clear summer's day, trimmed with a border of crescent moons, but as his blood seeped into it, the cloth darkened and the moons turned red one by one. Jane Poole wept so hysterically that Septa Mordane finally took her off to regain her composure, but Sansa sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching with a strange fascination. She had never seen a man die before. She ought to be crying too, she thought, but the tears would not come. Perhaps she had used up all her tears for Lady and Bran. It would be different if it had been Jory or Sir Roderick or father, she told herself. The young knight in the blue cloak was nothing to her, some stranger from the Vale of Arryn, whose name she had forgotten as soon as she heard it. And now the world would forget his name too, Sansa realized. There would be no song sung for him. That was sad. After they carried off the body, a boy with a spade ran onto the field and shoveled dirt over the spot where he had fallen to cover up the blood. Then the joust resumed. Sir Balon Swan also fell to Gregor, and Lord Renly to the Hound. Renly was on horse so violently that he seemed to fly backward off his charger, legs in the air. His head hit the ground with an audible crack that made the crowd gasp, but it was just the golden antler on his helm. One of the tines had snapped off beneath him. When Lord Renly climbed to his feet, the commons cheered wildly, for King Robert's handsome young brother was a great favourite. He handed the broken tine to his conqueror with a gracious bow. The hound snorted and tossed the broken antler into the crowd, where the commons began to punch and claw over the little bit of gold, until Lord Renly walked out among them and restored the peace. By then, Septa Mordane had returned, alone. Jane had been feeling ill, she explained. She had helped her back to the castle. Sansa had almost forgotten about Jane. Later, a hedge knight in a checkered cloak disgraced himself by killing Beric Dondarrion's horse and was declared forfeit. Lord Beric shifted his saddle to a new mount, only to be knocked right off by Thoris of Myr. Sir Aaron Santigar and Lothar Brun tilted thrice without result. Sir Aaron fell afterwards to Lord Jason Malister, and Brun to Jan Royce's younger son, Robar. In the end, it came down to four: the Hound and his monstrous brother, Gregor, Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, and Sir Loras Tyrell, the youth they called the Knight of Flowers. Sir Loras was the younger son of Mace Tyrell, the Lord of High Garden and Warden of the South. At 16, he was the youngest rider on the field, yet he had unhorsed three knights of the King's Guard that morning in his first three jousts. Sansa had never seen anyone so beautiful. His plate was intricately fashioned and enamelled as a bouquet of a thousand different flowers, and his snow-white stallion was draped in a blanket of red and white roses. After each victory, Sir Loras would remove his helm and ride slowly round the fence, and finally pluck a single white rose from the blanket and toss it to some fair maiden in the crowd. His last match of the day was against the younger Royce. Sir Robar's ancestral runes proved small protection as Sir Loras split his shield and drove him from his saddle to crash with an awful clangor in the dirt. Robar lay moaning as the victor made his circuit of the field. Finally, they called for a litter and carried him off to his tent, dazed and unmoving. Sansa never saw it. Her eyes were only for Sir Loras. When the white horse stopped in front of her, she thought her heart would burst. To the other maidens he had given white roses, but the one he plucked for her was red. "Sweet lady," he said, "no victory is half so beautiful as you." Sansa took the flower timidly, struck dumb by his gallantry. His hair was a mass of lazy brown curls, his eyes like liquid gold. She inhaled the sweet fragrance of the rose and sat clutching it long after Sir Loras had ridden off. When Sansa finally looked up, a man was standing over her staring. He was short, with a pointed beard and a silver streak in his hair, almost as old as her father. "You must be one of her daughters," he said to her. He had grey-green eyes that did not smile when his mouth did. "You have the Tully look." "I am Sansa Stark," she said, ill at ease. The man wore a heavy cloak with a fur collar, fastened with a silver mockingbird, and he had the effortless manner of a high lord. But she did not know him. "I have not had the honour, my lord." Septa Mordaine quickly took a hand. "Sweet child, this is Lord Petar Baelish of the King's Small Council." "Your mother was my queen of beauty once," the man said quietly. His breath smelled of mint. "You have her hair." His fingers brushed against her cheek as he stroked one auburn lock. Quite abruptly, he turned and walked away. By then, the moon was well up, and the crowd was tired, so the king decreed that the last three matches were to be fought the next morning before the melee. While the commons began their walk home, talking of the day's jousts and the matches to come on the morrow, the court moved to the riverside to begin the feast. Six monstrous huge aurochs had been roasting for hours, turning slowly on wooden spits, while kitchen boys basted them with butter and herbs until the meat crackled and spit. Tables and benches had been raised outside the pavilions, piled high with sweet grass and strawberries and fresh-baked bread. Sansa and Septa Mordaine were given places of high honour to the left of the raised dais, where the king himself sat beside his queen. When Prince Joffrey seated himself to her right, she felt her throat tighten. He had not spoken a word to her since the awful thing had happened, and she had not dared to speak to him. At first she thought she hated him for what they'd done to Lady, but after Sansa had wept her eyes dry, she told herself it had not been Joffrey's doing, not truly. The queen had done it. She was the one to hate, her and Arya. Nothing bad would have happened except for Arya. She could not hate Joffrey tonight. He was too beautiful to hate. He wore a deep blue doublet studded with a double row of golden lion's heads, and around his brow a slim coronet made of gold and sapphires. His hair was as bright as a metal. Sansa looked at him and trembled.